This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
Americans that sort of are starting to pay attention to these issues should be in favor of what we're asking for, which is prioritizing fire safety in and around communities. And then if there are wildland fires that are burning, but they aren't threats to people and property, to let them burn and not try to intercede as much in the cycle of life, death, and rejuvenation that happens all the time in our forests.
Massive wildfires, like the recent so-called Rim Fire, which threatened the region near Yosemite National Park, seem to be far too frequent events these days. The Rim Fire, which apparently was caused by a hunter's illegal campfire, is now thankfully 80% contained at the cost of about $100 million. But its effects are long-term and far-reaching, and they raise some important larger questions. Are we heading in the right direction in terms of forestry policy? Are we learning from past mistakes? And are fires like this always bad? This week on Sea Change Radio, we welcome back Rolf Skaar, the Director of Forestry Management for Greenpeace, to break down the impact of the Rim Fire and answer our questions about the broader context of this fire and its ilk. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Rolf Skaar. He is the Forest Campaign Director for Greenpeace. Rolf, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me again.
When we're talking about forests, the issue on everybody's mind right here in Northern California right now is this so-called Rim Fire. First, why don't you give us a quick overview of the fire for our national listeners and what it means in terms of the impact for this region?
Well, a lot of our listeners have seen the dramatic photos and video of the fire burning in the Stanislaus National Forest and parts of Yosemite National Park right next door. Of course, Yosemite is part of what has catapulted this fire into the national spotlight, and it is large. It's one of the largest in recent history in California, and I say recent history because some headlines have been getting it wrong and saying that it's one of the biggest ever in California. It's one of the biggest since we kept records, but certainly historically, before Europeans showed up, they were very, very large fires. And fires in the Sierras, this mountain ecosystem, are not unusual. If we do research on many of these forests, we find that many of them burned regularly and were part of the natural cycle of life, death, and rejuvenation in those forests. But the trouble now is, of course, there's been years and years of people doing things to the land and impacting even things like our climate. And we have a much closer relationship to some of these wildlands because we have things like dams that feed San Francisco's water supply. And we have many thousands of homes there too. And so things are getting complicated. And that's part of what have led to such high stakes at the Rim Fire.
What are the causes of most of these wildfires that we're seeing in these great swaths of our nation's forests, like the Rim Fire?
Most of the fires that start in the American West are actually started by humans. So no matter how hot or dry a forest is, it doesn't spontaneously burst into flame. It needs a spark or it needs a flame to get started. And naturally, by far the most common source of natural fire starts, or ignitions, as scientists call it, are lightning strikes. But during a drought like we're seeing now in California, those lightning strikes can be pretty rare. So you can be real hot and real dry, but the forest won't burn. There's some other freak kind of occurrences, like two stones knocking against each other during an avalanche, sending off a spark in just the right place. But those are pretty unusual. As a result, most of the fire starts come from people. And in California, that's things like machinery, number one, or catalytic converters that are misfiring a bit. A burning off of brush or other wastes, people intentionally set those fires. And then arson, unfortunately, is also up there. A lot of people are careless and sometimes intentionally reckless with fire.
So some of the headlines that we've read and seen almost annually, this is the fire of the year in California, but could have been in Colorado a couple of years before, and Southern California we've seen in the last few years. It's always like you're going to be seeing more and more of these as climate change becomes more and more of a reality.
Mm-hmm.
How do you and your colleagues at Greenpeace view that assertion?
Yeah, we think it's a pretty dramatic example of why we need to take action on climate change. Scientists have shown that fire activity globally is likely to increase with a hotter climate. Now, in some places, like some parts of the tropics, forest fire or wildland fire activity may decrease actually with climate change in the way that precipitation patterns may change. A lot of this is based on modeling, but for California and for many parts of the American West, there's near consensus that over time, we're going to see more and more fires. And all of that's going to be compounded too by the decades of mistakes that we've made with our forests and our forest management.
So one of the things that I imagine pops into your head is the Bush administration's Healthy Forest Initiative. That must be viewed as a mistake as well. Can you explain what that was and how we're seeing that policy played out today?
Yeah, the Healthy Forest Initiative was going to be paired with a piece of legislation that fortunately didn't pass. But it basically wanted to make larger loopholes for logging projects on national forests by suspending environmental review. So that means instead of going through a normal review process where you say, what's the impact going to be? Who will be affected? And what do they think? The Bush administration was looking just to have government officials, bureaucrats, making decisions for us while very much tipping their ear to the timber industry in the process.
And many of them came from that very industry.
That's right. So at the time, under the Bush administration, the guy in charge of the Forest Service was actually a decades-long timber lobbyist. So
who knows forests better than people who cut it down, right?
Nice guy, but certainly had an agenda. Mark Ray was his name. And so, yeah, people certainly come to those positions with backgrounds. That's not unprecedented, but it was very clear what this is all about. The only thing that seemed to be trying to hide the agenda was the name, the ironic name, the Healthy Forest Initiative.
This was a close cousin to the Clear Skies Initiative, I imagine.
Some people remember that one as well. So it became a bit of a joke, and thankfully a lot of people could see through that that greenwash.
So what's happening now under the Obama administration in the forest management area?
Yeah, we're not seeing a robust attack on national forests in the same way that the Bush administration pushed forward. There were some early disappointments, including logging or proposed logging in roadless areas in Alaska. And for a long time, roadless or, you know, the big wildlands, roadless is a technical term that the Forest Service used, but the big wildlands, the biggest, best wildlands left on our national forests were really something that Americans overwhelmingly, you know, regardless of political affiliation or if they voted not or cared about any of this stuff at all, just supported the idea of on their public lands. So the Obama administration early on had some incursions into roadless forests that a lot of people weren't really pleased with. And these days, there's still some really harmful logging projects proceeding forward in some parts of the country. Like Southeast Alaska, there's still some large logging projects going on where they shouldn't, threatening things like the rare a rare wolf that that lives just on the Alexander Archipelago. Greenpeace is working to correct that problem. In Southern Oregon, there's some controversial projects that have cropped up on Bureau of Land Management lands. So that's different than the Forest Service, but also manages a lot of federal lands, including a lot of federal forests.
Boy and his dog went out looking for the rainbow. You know what did they learn since that very day? Walking by the river and running like a blue streak through the fields and streams and meadows, laughing all the way. Oh, a redwood tree, please let us under. When we were young, we used to go under the redwood tree.
listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Rolf Skaar. He's the Forest Campaign Director for Greenpeace. Rolf, when you're trying to run a campaign based around protecting a species like the wolf, or most notably the spotted owl, how do you, as an organization, deflect the low-hanging fruit that the business and right-wing community can tap into to try to oversimplify the issue and say, you know, which is more important, jobs or this stupid little owl? How do you get away from that dynamic in the messaging?
Yeah, the jobs versus eat an owl, save a logger debate, that should have died probably in the late 90s, and it's still with us. I mean, that's being generous. It probably should have been dead in the 80s. The fact remains that the vast majority of forest products and forest product jobs come from private lands in the U.S. So Weyerhaeuser, for example, not to pick on anybody, but to say there's a big logging company. That's a company that makes an awful lot of wood products, paper, dimensional lumber, everything else. It hires a lot of people. They have nothing to do, really, with national forest logging. I mean, where their fiber and wood comes from is private lands. And there's a simple reason for that. The private lands tend to be the ones that are most productive. They're lower elevation. They're more accessible. The stuff that people are sort of fighting over that's in national forests, the last wildlands, the last roadless forests, last old growth forests, those kinds of things, are not where you're going to get your logging jobs from. If they were, they would have been logged already. But they do have important values, things like drinking water, recreation, all these things that are actually worth a lot more to our economy and to our communities, frankly, than subsidized, taxpayer-subsidized logging projects that repeat the mistakes of the past.
It doesn't make sense on a lot of levels when you say that the private lands are the low-hanging fruit, so to speak, of the logging industry. Why go through all the red tape and political fighting to try to cut down some of our national treasures?
Let's say you have a mill and it was sized for big old logs and you've run out of big old logs. There's only a few places where you can go get it again. So rather than retooling the mill and making it sort of ready for smaller logs that you can do other things with, there may be some sort of, if you will, dinosaurs in the industry that are stuck in the past and just want to do what they've always done, which, by the way, is a nice sentiment. We hear this a lot. Like, my dad worked in this industry here this way. We cut trees that were 7 feet wide. I want to keep doing that sort of thing. That said, I know a few people in the American economy who can say that they've been doing what their parents or their parents' parents did. And it's not because of a spotted owl. It's because the world has changed. And it's changing faster than ever. And that if you don't embrace change and innovation in today's American economy, you're likely to be left either grasping at subsidized straws, which won't last, or in the dustbin.
And the processing of these cut down forests has shifted, whether these people like it or not, from when their parents or grandparents worked in the industry, correct?
That's right. I mean, now our timber industry is in the global economy, whether we like it or not. They're competing with foreign sources, and they're relying on foreign and domestic markets. And so a lot of the most reckless, economically reckless and ecologically reckless logging that we've seen on the West Coast over the years has been the export of basically raw logs, or logs that have been very minimally processed and shipped to Asia, usually, to be processed into things. Now, the thing is, when you process wood into things, you're giving people jobs. If you're making a table instead of just exporting the log that makes the table, you've made many more people be able to bring home the bacon, if you will.
Let's step back to the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, when American children first got to know Smokey the Bear.
Mm-hmm.
What did that mean for the forestry movement and your work, and how has that evolved today? Where are we beyond just that needle that shows the fire risk in your region? That was something that urban kids were getting exposed to watching TV in the 70s. Now it's like, not unless you're going up to Yosemite or Yellowstone or a national forest where you start seeing those fire risk areas, then you become aware of the reality of it.
Yeah. to put it simply, Smokey the Bear was wrong. And Smokey has changed over the years as a result of our changing understanding. But at first, Smokey was not just there to remind us to put out our campfires or not to be careless with matches, which is what he talks about today. But he was really sort of stirring up a fear of fire and the sense that fire was bad no matter what. And a lot of that actually came from a very old school approach to forest management, which first was based on very limited understanding in science and thought that we could change things. Yes, there were fires in the past, but now with our new technology and our American ingenuity, we'll put out all those fires. We'll put them all out. We'll have control over this natural forest in the same way that we have control over rivers and other things that we engineer. And that will make sure that we keep things green and the timber industry will be happy because there'll be less of a risk that some of their stands of wood volume will decrease because of a fire. So a lot of Smokey was about protecting a resource that the timber industry was very interested in. And what we found out over the years is that you can't do that. That if you put out every fire, what you're doing is actually setting up a time bomb because fires will happen. And if there haven't been fires in a fire-adapted ecosystem, in a place where fires have historically happened, you'll build up fuels, you'll make all kinds of things happen that sort of guarantee that it's going to be worse when it does happen. And that's commonly acknowledged now. The timber industry uses that line to justify more logging. Conservationists use it, like myself, to critique some of the management in the past. But there's one thing we can agree on, and that is putting out every fire simply doesn't work.
And what do you and your colleagues at Greenpeace think is a better solution?
Well, first of all, we have lots of communities that are at high risk of fire. And so if we're talking about going in with a chainsaw anywhere to do what's called fuels reduction, and that can take many forms. It can be removing brush around houses, or it can be logging old growth in the backcountry. We would vote for the former rather than the latter. In other words, prioritize your fire safety and your fuels reduction work in and around communities to keep people and property safe first. And I don't think there's an excuse for doing some sort of thinning project or some quote-unquote fuels reduction project that's actually a subsidized logging project way in the backcountry when there's a single community at high risk. And the Forest Service has done assessments of communities around the West, and there are many thousands of communities that are basically sitting around at that high risk level, and I don't think that's conscionable.
As I step out one morning into a small cafe, a 40-year-old waitress to me these words did say. She said, "I see, sir, you're a logger, and not just a common bum, 'cause nobody but a logger stirs his coffee with his thumb. My lover was a logger, there's none like him today. If you'd pour a little whiskey upon it, he'd eat a bale of hay."
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm talking to Rolf Scar. He is the Forest Campaign Director for Greenpeace. Getting back to the Eat an Owl, Save a Logger campaign, where do you think the compelling argument should be for ones who don't consider themselves tree huggers, but actually mm-hmm. like to breathe clean air and drink clean water?
Well, those Americans, I mean, these are their national forests too. And also, although there are some communities closer to these national forests than others, they're not state forests, they're not county forests, they're national forests. It was a system set up wisely many years ago, recognizing that there are such things as shared resources in this country for things like wildlife habitat, drinking water, recreation opportunities. By the way, recreation many millions of dollars and growing quickly, and much more important to many communities, rural communities, than subsidized logging projects. But that's a different story. So I think Americans that sort of are starting to pay attention to these issues should be in favor of what we're asking for, which is prioritizing fire safety in and around communities. And then if there are wildland fires that are burning, but they aren't threats to people and property, to let them burn and not try to intercede as much in the cycle of life, death, and rejuvenation that happens all the time in our forests. And as a historical note, many of the forests in the Sierra probably should have burned many more times since the early 1900s. But because of the success, if you will, of the fire suppression efforts, they haven't. And so some fire scientists are saying, well, this is sort of a long time coming, whether it was...
When you say this, do you mean this?
The Rim Fire. I mean, there had been some fires in that region recently, but that whole area, certainly you could say, had a lot of fire suppression. And so, or at least the effects of fire suppression over many years. We're going to have to learn how to develop a new relationship with fire. Not to say that it should ever threaten our homes or communities, or that people should breathe smoke when they don't want to, but we're going to have to develop a new relationship with fire, because we're going to be forced to. Ecologically, there's no way to not have fires in these kinds of forests. There's just no way not for this not to happen. So that's a scientific fact. The second thing is, it sure seems like things are going to get hotter and drier over time, and scientists are telling us that that's going to mean drier and hotter summers, and that's going to mean the conditions will be there for more fires if they get started, and more extreme fires. And the other thing is, we are running out of money. The Forest Service runs out of money every year fighting fires. It's as predictable as the fire season itself, and it's a huge expense. The Forest Service is now in the process of transferring $600 million from other programs. So even things like fire safety programs and other restoration programs that do long-term good for our communities and our forests, they're basically moving those funds over, cannibalizing those funds to deal with an emergency. And we can't keep going on like this. We can't have the Forest Service and other useful programs being basically slashed in a non-democratic process at the last minute. Just to fight fire.
Is it a question of fund management or the amount of funds or allowing certain fires to go unfought?
I think a lot of it is actually just the budgeting. So there are budgets for emergencies in the U.S. And I think people can complain all they like, but when an emergency happens to their community, they'll be glad that those funds are there. Forest fires, wildland fires are not budgeted that way. There's no scientific fire forecast that is used to budget, and dedicated budgeting tends not to happen, even though there's been interest in sort of making that happen in recent years. So the Forest Service is always left scrambling at the last minute at just the wrong time, when really people should be focusing on the job at hand. They have to worry about where they're going to get the money from to pay those heroic firefighters and smoke jumpers and the rest that are on the front lines trying to keep people and property safe.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Rolf Skaar. He's the Forest Campaign Director for Greenpeace. Getting back to the science for a second, Rolf, we had a guest on last year, a professor from Indiana University, Richard Phillips, who had done some research, and there's similar research from Duke University that's showing that trees don't produce as much oxygen as previously thought. And that's probably, it's a good thing that we realize this as soon as we can, and talk about how it may affect reducing what generally was thought of as an effective way to put monies into carbon offset programs, and mm-hmm. how organizations are now trying to reduce the amount of forestry in their carbon offset portfolios.
Yeah. Well, first, you know, it should be noted that not only are things going to be hotter and drier in our forests in California and across the American West, and not only can we expect more forest fires, especially if we don't take aggressive action now to cut carbon emissions, that seems pretty clear. But forest fires aren't the only things that that sort of mark the intersection between our forests and climate change. One thing that you're alluding to is, just sort of the day-to-day processes. How do these forests take in carbon dioxide and give out oxygen? And what are the limits to those things? So things like moisture or nutrients, and indeed heat and temperature and those kinds of things, and the CO2 itself present in the air can all affect how plants and trees do the whole carbon cycle thing that we learned in elementary school. And what we're noticing is that changes to the climate are starting to change the way that forests interact with our climate. And it can set up sort of a feedback loop where the hotter and drier it gets in California, the less forests can naturally take in that carbon dioxide, the less of a buffer that they become.
And also, I guess one of the controls also that needs to be considered is the old growth versus the younger trees.
That's right. The old growth versus the younger trees. Sometimes the timber industry will say the young trees are growing faster. They're more vibrant. That's what you want there. So let us log the old growth. But of course, that totally ignores the fact that an old growth forest is not just the trees. It's also everything else that is accumulated over time. Old growth forests tend to be more like big carbon piggy banks where you've got standing dead trees, big old logs on the forest floor, thick topsoil that if you reach your hand into it, you know, you probably felt this before, that sort of thick, moist, organic material that is above the mineral soil, that's all stored carbon. And there's carbon in the root systems as well.
And it's a vibrant ecosystem with animal life, and it's a little world unto itself as opposed to going to a Christmas tree.
A Christmas tree farm does not have as much carbon stored, even though sometimes timber industry apologists try to argue that it's better from a climate perspective.
Or cutting down rainforest to plant palm oil
trees. Yeah, there's very few people that defend that anymore, even though they're still doing it. And that's a whole other story. So that draws into question. If you say, okay, I want to keep polluting through my cancer-causing coal plant, for example. I don't want to change to cleaner energies. I just want to keep polluting. I want to buy a get-out-of-jail-free card in the form of a patch of forest somewhere that has a theoretical carbon value that we're going to calculate that will translate into a theoretical amount of coal that I can keep burning and spewing into the atmosphere and harming people's health with. That whole scenario, as unsound as it is from the start, gets less sound when you start learning like, oh my goodness, trees and plants are behaving differently with a changing climate than we thought they were. So now we've got to go back to our calculations. And the trouble is with that sort of an offset, that sort of trading, if you will, or I like to call it sort of an outsourcing of clean air and clean air technology and jobs, is that you've already burned your coal. And the theoretical benefits that you thought you were going to get from protecting a patch of forest, that turned out never to be there.
He's Ralph Scar. He's the Forest Campaign Director for Greenpeace. Ralph, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by James Brown, Johnny Cash, and Van Morrison. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.